Thank you everyone for being here. We're here with Jean Thompson, who is ECU's 2015 visiting writer, and she's going to just talk to us a little bit about her writing process.
Do you all know from your own writing that generating an idea is, you know, there's no process. There's the closest I could come is to say, well, what is it that is bugging you? What is it? Where is the darkness leading you? What intrigues you or hooks your curiosity? And sometimes it's a matter of saying, well, I feel like writing a particular kind of piece. I feel like writing a comedy, or I feel like writing something that shows characters moving through time, or I feel like writing a novel instead of stories, or form, you know, can be an impetus. But there is a sense when you're contemplating what to write first, and again, you know this from your own experience, that there's a kind of a portable phase where you walk around banging into walls and stuff going, yeah, I could write this thing. It would be about this guy who did this thing. Or no, it would be this way. And all of these great ideas present themselves to you as possibilities, and you see which ones you can follow, which ones are going to be productive. And by the way, I think learning to throw away or give up on a piece of writing that isn't going anywhere is part of the process of learning how to write. This is leading me straight into that brick wall. This seemed like a good idea at the time. Time to bail.
So you've written a lot of short stories and novels. Have you ever sort of had something that began as a short story that emerged into something else? Or do you tend to think that you sort of know what form will fit?
I know. I'm sorry. I'm giving you all the wrong answers here. I'm supposed to say, I was writing this story and I was so seized by these characters that I had to write 300 pages about them. It's never happened. I have a lot of fidelity to form. You know, a short story is so much different than a novel, to me at least. A short story is, what can you fit into this more or less finite space? Short stories being 30 to 50 pages long, I guess, if you want to stretch it. But it has to have this certain, you know, conflict, tension, resolution structure, and it also has to, you also have to pack in all of those items, characterization and description and voice. Everything has to fit into this more or less circumscribed box. And a novel is more like inventing a world, and it can take any shape or form. And you do have to pay attention to tension and a reader wanting to keep reading. But a novel is more of an invention. Where do I want to go with this? There are conventions in novels, but you can decide to make up your own. I think novels lend themselves more to that. So no, I've never had that experience, which isn't to say I won't someday. And I love the short story format. I really do. I love the economy of it. I love being able to make that tight turn so that you have a feeling something is different by the end. Something's happened.
And can you talk a little bit about how you draft novels as opposed to stories? Talking about, like,
nothing's different. Nothing's different. The drafting process is sitting on your butt. I used to write longhand on yellow legal pads. Now I do sit at a computer. I print it out a lot. But the drafting process is exactly the same. It's trying to get one damn word to follow another. There's nothing different about that nuts and bolts part of the process. What, did you think there should be?
No, I was more curious about sort of how, because you read pretty much a completed chapter from A Novel in Progress right now. Uh-huh. But do you tend to find that you go through a full draft before you go back and start rewriting? Do you structure a chapter at a time?
Well, for me, and this doesn't have to be the way everybody works, I'm pretty much a brick-by-brick writer. Here's the brick. I put it in place. I mortar another brick next to it, and I make sure that that row of bricks is okay, and then I put the next row on. You see how literal I am. But I pretty much have to be happy with what I've done before I can take another step out into the next thing to do. I do revise along the way, and then, of course, when you're done, you revise, and there are people called editors that sometimes make you revise things when you'd rather not. But for me, just my process is I have to know where I start so that I can go a little farther than that.
Yeah. I'm curious, too, about The Witch and Other other stories. Yeah. Because, you know, you said that you prefer realism to the fantastic. Uh-huh. And so what drew you to that project of taking...
Well, but they're very realistic stories, right. You know. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, that's the last book, which is a book that kind of riffs on fairy tales, I'd say that, as opposed to versions of them. Like Little Red Riding Hood is about a 13-year-old girl who's up in her bedroom on the computer doing, you know, nasty things in chat room, but also taking food to her granny's house. And, you know, there are those wolves that she kind of likes, you know. So, I mean, it's very loosely based on fairy tales. Hansel and Gretel are two neglected children who end up in foster care with a kind of a grim foster mom. So, you know, what I was doing, I'm taking the fantastic, but leeching all the fantastic out of it. But that kind of gets back to something Tom was quoting me, you know, say something on the internet and it's there forever, about being interested in the real world, which I am. Who could want for anything more? I'd like to think that those fairy tale situations, those archetypes, echo in our actual lives. And so that's where I was approaching it from. So I do have a story with a talking dog. He talks to a woman who has a history of mental illness. It's my mental illness story, you know. And there are places where her head is spinning a little bit. But the only manifestation of craziness is the dog talks to her. That disappointed somebody. It's like, well, you know, the one time that there could have been something really fun, like a talking dog, you know, talks to this woman who's... That set me in that direction, because that's what you were asking, is I was trying to think, what is it that fascinates us about certain types of stories? Because, you know, fairy tales, which are worldwide, there are versions of these things, archetypes of these things, in every culture. You know, a folklorist could tell you more than I could, but what is it about them that appeals to us and that makes them last? Iteration after iteration, version after version. And one of the things that I realized just in the process of thinking about this is I have my own versions that I grew up. My version of Cinderella must be different than, that must be the real version as opposed to that Disney cartoon that you grew up on. And not so, not so. You know, there's no authenticity, or you have to let go of that notion. So does that answer your question?
Definitely.
Okay.
Anyone else?
I have a question, just because I often think that it would have been really difficult to be the only woman in a group of men.
Tell me about it.
In an MFA program.
My God.
But what struck me when we talked about it was actually, I think there might have been some real benefits to that.
Well, you get to be the queen of the silver dollar, I'm telling you.
You probably remember, but I just wanted to kind of, like, ask you about that, how it felt. Also,
it was a little scary at first. The thing that Tom didn't say is, you know, I was just a brat. I was just a little jerk, and I was just full of it. And, you know, nobody's going to put me down for gender reasons. And these guys were enlightened enough that they wanted to at least pretend that they had that kind of cultural sensitivity. This is the first time we're all assembling for an MFA class, because there's no orientation or anything like that. It's just show up at this classroom. So we're all kind of, you know, looking around, and I'm looking around going, they're all dudes, you know. Oh, how interesting is this? Hey. So that's kind of what it was like, you know. And there was a larger universe. Tom and Santa were married. They were newlyweds, if you can believe that. And there were a couple other people that were also married or had girlfriends. So it's not like you're the only female in the orbit. But there were times that I had to call the gentleman to task in workshop. You know, I was a jerk. I still am, but nobody was going to tell me that I wasn't allowed to do what I was doing.
And you knew that you wanted to be a writer.
Oh, I don't know what I knew, you know, but I knew what I was doing. I mean, I knew why I was there at that moment. Nobody knows anything. Yeah.
This just popped into my head. But you taught at Illinois for quite a few years. But how was your experience in seeing your students in workshop? How was it different from what your experience was like in the 70s, I guess?
Oh, How do the students change?
I guess how was the workshop setting different, maybe?
I'm not sure there were big differences. I mean, there's always a difference in the culture and the things that people are preoccupied about. I mean, I taught undergrads for most of my time at Illinois. I've taught grad students there once we got a grad program. I've taught grad students at other places. So I don't know. It was more like, you know, what was life like in the 70s, 80s, and 90s? Because it's all reflective and what people are writing about, and whether they want to be wildly experimental or taking on taboos. So it has more to do with the life of the culture. A workshop is a workshop is a workshop is a workshop.
Well, that one sounded slightly less formal than ours.
But oh, that, well, that's probably the exception. I don't really know how to account for that, except that I think there was this kind of era of, I call them the dinosaur guys. You know, there was this artistic persona that you adapted, which had to do with drinking heavily and behaving badly and being as Dionysian as you possibly could. And that somehow validated your artistry. And that was very appealing, of course. And a lot of bad behavior that was part of saying, in order to be an artist, I have to be F. Scott Fitzgerald jumping in the fountain with Zelda or something. A lot of romanticizing of alcoholism, I think, you know, which didn't end well for anybody. God knows you can still find that. But that's so antithetical to getting your work done. You know, you can't work, you can't get paid. You know, you can do it in fits and starts. You can be brilliant here and there and stuff, but it's not a good work ethic. So I do think there was that Charles Bukowski, you know, kind of, I'm an artist, therefore I behave badly.
Speaking of work ethic, when you were teaching full-time, how did you balance the writing schedule?
Oh, man, I was younger. I look back, I thought, how did I do that? But we always had a teaching schedule that was manageable. You would teach maybe 2 days a week or 3 days a week and, you know, have to go in for other stuff, or so that you would have chunks of time. But any day that I wasn't teaching or didn't have some other goofy thing to do, go to the dentist, you know, you sit down and you write. I mean, I had bales of homework. I mean, you tell these kids to write a whole lot, then you have to read it, you know. So there was always, you know, kind of, you know. But I'm pretty organized. So it's like, get up in the morning, do your damn work. Weekends here, time to do your damn work. But really, it's so much easier when you don't have to do any of those things. Try and be parasites. Live in your parents' basement.
When we study fiction, usually we study the short story form.
Yeah.
Even though it seems like everyone just wants to write novels. And those of us who are holding on to the love of the short story are sometimes told that, you know, maybe it's kind of dead, or it's not practical.
Oh, I'm so tired of hearing that.
How do you feel about the short story then?
How do I feel about the death of the short story? I've been hearing that for nigh on 50 years or something. That's not the case. It's really not. And all it takes is the next short story writer that people get excited about. George Saunders or, I mean, there's always a Vogue. There's always the, you know, who's the new hot writers you guys like, the Karen, what's her name?
Karen Russell.
But all those people. They're just not to my taste. But, you know, they get attention for doing something different and new. And you know, you could go back through and say, well, here's, you know, Raymond Carver. My God, you know, that was a big 180-degree turn. When I was in grad school, I feel like that commercial that shows Bodie Miller as a grandfather now. When I was in grad school, which was a long time ago, there was this big vogue for experimentalism. This was John Barth and Barthelmay and, kind of these puppet master narratives. Let us begin our story with characters who shall be called Jane and John. I mean, there was a very self-conscious experimentalism that, you know, produced some nice things, but there was a vogue for that, and some of it got kind of silly, and some of it also got repetitive. It's one thing to have something that's a new experiment. It's something else to write something that's just like the last experiment. So there was that kind of vogue, and I remember telling my workshop teacher about, oh, yeah, so-and-so wrote this story, and it's about this family, and, you know, he loses his job, and then blah, 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 and the guy saying, but, you know, you can't write stories like that anymore. You can't. It has to be artsied up and weird and everything. Then we have Raymond Carver, who, oh, guess what? You can write stories about the people that shop at Kmart. It's called Blue Light Special Fiction because all the characters are kind of humping along. And what a revelation and what a turn. And then, of course, everybody wanted to write like Raymond Carver. And people still do today. It was very influential. And Carver never wrote a thing but short stories. So I think if you, and I'm sure there's someone in this building more qualified than I to go back through contemporary literary history and say, who were the people who really made it new again? And I'm tired of hearing that short stories are dead or dying. You know, then we got into, oh, what's the guy's name? David Shields. Novels are dead. Novels are now dead. And all you can write are lists and pastiches because our culture is such that we now borrow from everything. It's like, fine. You know, it's like... I did write a review of somebody's short stories, I think Deborah Eisenberg, which I referred to David Shields. It's like, well, now we hear, you know, we've been hearing that short stories, you know, are dead. We've been hearing that for a long time. And now there's this other movement of novels are dead. Welcome novels to the land of the unquiet dead, because that's what short stories are. Now, it's true that you can no longer, as F. Scott Fitzgerald did, make a living sending stories to the Saturday Evening Post. And it's true that the mass market for narrative has gone somewhere else. But, you know, I remember those Saturday Evening Post stories, I mean, after F. Scott Fitzgerald's time, but they were pretty drippy. They were sort of like Lassie Comes Home. They were formulaic. You know, they're kind of the equivalent of airport paperbacks. Does that answer your question? That's what I think. Write stories. The hell with everybody else. Hey, who won the National Book Award this last year? Phil Clay, Stories, Redeployment.
It seems like a lot of people were just, by saying stories dead, it's just a way of being dismissive of it because it's not what you want to read or you think it's a lesser form, but it's a totally different form. I had a professor who was like, well, you learn how to write short story and then you move on to novels.
It's an etude for the novel. Well, for some people it is, right. And that's okay. Stories are harder to sell to the movies. I think there's a lot of self-fulfilling prophecy on publishers' part. Oh, stories don't sell. It's like, well, they would if you invested some resources in it. There is a lower expectation for sales of short story collections, absolutely, unless you just won the National Book Award and you're going to write your second volume of stories or something. But a lot of it is self-fulfilling prophecy, I really do think.
Would you mind talking about how you began to publish stories?
Okay. Back in the old days, Grandma Bodie's old days. And Tom and I were talking about this last night, that there were literary magazines, nothing was online, we didn't have the internet, and you would take your typed copy and you would put it in a brown envelope. And then you would have your return envelope also with postage. And, you know, we were broke as grad students, just broke. But you still put aside money so that, you know, you have the inside postage and go to the post office and weigh what the manuscript with return postage and then put it all in the big envelope and see if that needed more postage. So, I mean, that was the mechanics of it, which was tedious. And, again, I know I'm quoting myself because I've said the same thing about literary magazines. There was this, you know, kind of universe of small magazines, and you made judgments about it. Did I talk about the Richard Ford introduction to somebody in which he talks about when he was trying to write stories, and he'd say, oh, I'd send them to, I think I was talking about this at lunch the other day, that, you know, I'd say, oh, okay, I'll write to the editor of the Mississippi Review and say that I was born in Mississippi. Yeah, that'll make him really pay attention. And I'll say I went to Michigan State, so the Michigan Quarterly should publish me. But kind of, you know, trying to find your place in, you know, that universe of little bitty magazines. And we didn't know nothing from nothing, you know. But here's one. What was the first magazine I published in? It was called the Ball State University Forum. I thought it was great. But then, you know, there's this hierarchy, you know, well, but New England Review is better than that. You know, maybe once I've said I'm published in Ball State University Forum, then maybe I could get into New England Review, and then maybe Esquire, you know, whatever. So, but really it's just a process of seeing what's out there. You know, what's out there and what might fit. If, you know, and I'd say when you start doing this, if you get 4 or 5 rejections from a place, that place isn't for you. You know, it's just not worth it. Move on.
What about your first book?
What about it? It came out, the University of Illinois Press had a short story series, you know, which was doing pretty well, and so it seemed like kind of an easy fit to do. And, you know, the only thing I really remember about that is I had a copy editor that wanted to rewrite every story, you know, and you learn what stet means, you know, stet is where you as it was, you know, and, you know, of the copy editor having to be, leashed and muzzled, you know, so that she wouldn't revise all my stories.
So you were working in Illinois at the time?
Yeah,
right?
Okay. I was, yeah.
Have you had a book that you felt was the most challenging to write in terms of, I guess, either going to sort of a subject matter that was difficult? We've talked about, like, going to a different culture in the writing, or sort of more...
Drawing a blank, you know. I mean, they're all hard, you know. And you know, I mean, my writing's all pretty much of a piece, you know. I mean, one of these days I want to write a mystery, you know, set in a university, you know. And I'm going to have so much fun. It's you know, the one that's hardest is the one you're working on now. I'm getting a little sore throated. So, you know, if there any other great thoughts, great questions.
That might be a good place to stop them. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, because I'm running out of wit as well as running out of advice. You all have been great. I've enjoyed my week with you.
You've been wonderful.
Thank you. You see what you've done to me? A shadow of my former self.